Charm of Favor, Chapter 3. Silicon Desert is brutally dry and hot in the summer, and although Phoenix looked large on the map, its population was strangely absent most of the time, except for an occasional dust storm the weather desk at KNXV-TV ran in automatic. July was one of those months in between sporting events that sometimes filled the arenas or stadiums in the city. It wasn't anything like the lush, green city of Tuscaloosa, or the fame he was used to as a player for the University of Alabama under legendary coach Gene Stallings. Christopher Sine thought he wanted to be a reporter, so he took a job with ABC. It was a big pond, and he was a little fish in a town that was more famous for its basketball team than anything else. He never wanted to be a sports writer. It was a struggle to be noticed in this business, but then he was used to third down and 5 yards to go. Coach Stallings always said, "Just do your job and everything else will be just fine." "I am doing my job," he told himself, cranking the air conditioning up a notch on his white Camry. Everybody drove white cars in Phoenix. It could reach 150 degrees in a dark-colored car in just a few minutes. White was cooler, or so everyone told him. It was just another thing that prevented him from standing out, from being noticed. Most of the tall office buildings downtown were owned by banks like Wells Fargo or Coldwell, but they, too, had laid off enough people to leave all but one floor of the parking structure empty. No story there. His source had called him on a Sunday night from Baltimore and said he had a tip. Some guy had a message that had to be delivered in person. It couldn't be texted or emailed. He pulled into the nearly empty parking lot as his dashboard clock strained to indicate noon in the bright sunshine coming in through the vehicle's factory windows. Since he had been in Phoenix, the Hooters on Main Street usually only had a couple of tables occupied for lunch at noon. A downtown venue like this, in any other city, would be packed for lunch. But this city felt like the day after the filming of a zombie apocalypse. It was Monday, June 27th, 2016. Maybe this was the big one. He removed his Oakleys and folded them into his shirt pocket. There were two guys at one high table in blue short sleeves with khaki pants. The round table in the corner booth was occupied by what looked like programmer geeks having working lunch with the latest tablets in front of thick glasses and bright orange polo shirts. "Are you Sine?" came the female voice from behind him. "Yeah, Chris Sine. I was expecting a..." He paused. "How are you?" he said, shaking her hand. She had a firm grip and skinny jeans and tan combat boots that he quickly surmised might be former military issue. The boots were old enough. Her eyes were brown, and she wore no makeup, which really was no surprise for Phoenix, as the temperature can exceed 116 degrees during the day. One wipe of the brow and the whole morning's work on a face could be ruined. "I have a table in the corner," she said, turning in that direction. "Oh, hey," said Chris to the waitress, who intercepted him. "I'm not eating, but I'll have a sweet tea if that's okay," said Chris. "You got it. I'll bring it right over." "Welcome to Hooters," said the waitress over the shoulder of her undersized white T-shirt. He always wondered about the job interview process at Hooters. "Maybe there was a story there," he exhaled slowly as he turned to catch up with the informant. At times like this, he learned to open all the senses. It was no fun having your touchdown stolen because you put your head down, covered the ball, and plowed toward the goal only to be crushed by an orange freight train angling across the field. "J.P. said you had something for me?" he asked so that only she could hear. "I work at General Aviation at Sky Harbor. Something's going on, and someone needs to know," she said, looking at him from under her wide, dark eyebrows and her closely trimmed black hair. "Drugs? What's up? What's your name? Can I quote you on this?" asked Chris in a rush of questions. "Look, Bill Clinton's plane has been at the airport for a day or so. We fueled it up this morning, and it originally filed a flight plan to leave out today," she said. "Hey, I don't do much, but I really don't do politics. I mean, I know it's an election year, but nothing really counts until Labor Day anyway. So, Miss, trailed Chris, my name is Sheila. No, you can't quote me. Listen, there is another plane coming in from Baltimore tonight after midnight, and that's a change of schedule as well. It wasn't supposed to arrive until the next day. It's the U.S. Attorney General's plane. They're going to hook up a GA at Sky Harbor at around 2:30 in the morning. The question you need to ask, Mr. Sine, is why the hell are these two sneaking around meeting at General Aviation at 2:30 in the freaking morning? Something's going down. Something bad, said Sheila. Here's your tea, sir. I didn't know if you wanted lemon, so here's a couple just in case, said the waitress. Oh, yeah, you're right, I forgot to ask, said Chris. Well, I figured with that accent you would take the lemons, she said, smiling. What accent? He asked, smiling back and pushing the straw into the glass. I gotta go, said Sheila. No, you don't. I need some answers before I go out there and make a mess, said Chris. What do you want to know? Asked Sheila with her hands flat on the tall round table. Besides everything? Let's see. Why was Bill Clinton here in Phoenix? Maybe he had campaign business here. How about, is this the first time they have met out here in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night? How about this one? Why would the husband of a presidential candidate who happens to be under federal investigation for mishandling classified information on a scale no one has ever seen in this country's history be meeting with the one government official who could put her away right before her inevitable election to the office of President of the United States? Asked Chris, nervously taking a sip of tea. Why the hell do you think I am here? Your boy in Baltimore calls me up and tells me to meet you face to face, and that you would take it from here. Do not overlook what I am risking, just talking to you. He's been here for a couple of days. Some dudes from some real estate development company met him. I saw their Escalades in the VIP slots outside GA this week. The thing is, whenever we see a last-minute reschedule of a charter plane, we take notice. It's DHS crap we have to go through. Well, when I look at the manifest and I saw that Lynch was on the plane, I about shit. I see the news. I'm not stupid, said Sheila. Why would you even care? This is going to make a nice headline on page 8 below the fold, but what difference does all this make anyway? Why would my source in Baltimore tell me to meet with you? Asked Chris. He could see the play. The offense was going to play an option. Something in the defense made the quarterback nervous. He had seen this kind of risk-taking before. I'm from Arkansas. My dad was a cop in Arkansas. His best friend and favorite source was Danny Casolaro. Ring a bell? Asked Sheila, opening her brown eyes wide at him. I'm from Alabama. Sorry, said Chris. Look, Danny was a reporter found in a hotel bathtub cut to pieces, slashed about 20 times, and bled to death. They got him in his hotel room in West Virginia, for God's sake. My dad says they killed him right before Bill Clinton was elected because Danny was working on a story that would end him, gritted Sheila with a little acid on her voice. I heard there was a string of bodies around those two, said Chris, becoming distant. Listen, Mr. Sine, she said, clearing her throat of the memory that took her breath away. The Attorney General of the freaking United States amended a flight plan to meet the head of the bloodiest crime gang in political history in the middle of the night. I'm telling you, no one knows about this. You need to be there, said Sheila, pointing her tanned finger at him. You gonna be there? Asked Chris. I work day shift. Besides, if I showed up, I'm as good as dead. I'm not here, said Sheila, dropping off the high chair. She looked at the door, turned, and walked out without turning around. Chris exhaled. He felt like the quarterback had just called time out right before the ball was snapped. He could feel the adrenaline in his system. He tried to think of how to approach this opportunity. If he didn't go, a crime was going to take place without a witness. He couldn't imagine what would happen if he did go. He thumbed a $5 bill on the table, put his Oakleys on, and walked out the door into the searing heat of the Phoenix daylight. Main Street was vacant like it was New Year's Day at 6 o'clock in the morning. What the hell happened to this town? He asked himself, looking both ways at green lights for blocks without a single car in sight. He took out his cell phone while he was walking to his car, noticed the time, and then put it back in his pocket. He opened the door, sat down, and stepped on the brake and hit the start button. He waited for the air conditioning to clear out the hot air in the car before closing the door. It would be nice to have a blocker when running a play, but sometimes you have to improvise. He wanted the story. His contact in Baltimore thought he was the right man to break it. He felt like the whole universe was about to pivot in the next 14 hours. In times like this, it's nice to be able to see the future, or at least have a playbook. He drew X's and O's in his mind while he drove back to the ABC News office. The play action, the option, the drive up the middle, nothing was working out right. It was confusing and dark, like playing in freezing rain for a Monday night game. What would cause one of the most powerful men in the world to take such a risk this close to an election? He asked himself. Hell, the most powerful woman in the world was 5 months away from being handed the nuclear codes. Someone had to tell the truth. It might as well be him. He pulled into the ABC garage and found a place to park. Not much ever happened in Phoenix. The elevator was empty. Most of the reporters were still out to lunch or looking for a story that would keep them indoors where they could stay looking nice. He was an anchor without a private office. It wasn't that uncommon. Even Fox News anchors have tiny little closet offices. There were 42 desks on the cubicle floor with private offices all the way around the perimeter of the 8th floor of the ABC building. He spun his black chair around and sat down, feeling like a rookie. He didn't have a clue what the play was on this story. He opened his drawer and got out his SLR digital camera. It had a good charge on it. It was a graduation present, and still had the same memory card with a few minor celebrities and some traffic accidents stored in it. He felt the pressure of what the next 12 hours might mean. He had to stay quiet for now. No one knew about this. No one was supposed to know about this. He had been given a glimpse of the future. A meteor striking the planet might not have as much impact as this meeting between Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch on the tarmac of the Sky Harbor Airport in the middle of the night. Bill Clinton, actively playing the role of Queenmaker, and the U.S. Attorney General were about to make a deal face-to-face, and he was one of the very few people who knew about it. Sheila was scared, but she was angry. He had seen that before. People sometimes live their whole lives with that hatred burning inside them. It aged them. It prevented them from ever loving anyone or trusting anyone. He didn't want to be one of those people. He took a deep breath and thought about going to the gym to work off the adrenaline still making him quiver. Yeah, that was a good idea. He moved the mouse on his computer, but then remembered he had shut it down when he left that morning. He didn't need to read the news anyway. He was about to make the news. Clinton was maneuvering for private FaceTime with the Attorney General. He was going to be there when it happened. The Observer, with anonymous sources inside both the FBI and the United States Secret Service, would publish that the Attorney General was caught completely off guard by the meeting. Officially, they dismissed suggestions alleging that she waited there to see Bill Clinton or accommodated his request to see him. Chris later discovered that this supposed source was none other than Clinton, working the back channels by asking for favors from agents loyal to him. He parked his Camry a little after midnight outside Sky Harbor General Aviation. Chris knew Clinton's plane had been scheduled to leave long before hers arrived, but he could see it was still there, still connected to the power cord that kept the air conditioning running inside the custom business jet. He knew Lynch's plane was originally scheduled to arrive the next day, and that she had amended her flight plan and flew all night after her lecture in Baltimore to get to Sky Harbor's General Aviation tarmac to make this very auspicious meeting. It was less than 2 hours when he saw the blinking white light on the department's regional jet flashing off hangars before the nose cleared the hangar of the end of the row. It had to be Lynch's jet. He witnessed it taxi to less than 75 yards away from Clinton's jet in the early hours of Tuesday morning. He stood alone on the still smoldering concrete pad surrounded with a tall decorative fence made of vertical bars. The air stairs on Lynch's jet went down, and an Air Force airman descended to stand at attention at the front of the stairs. It was still 100 degrees at 2:30 a.m. on June 29, 2016. The tall fence around the patio of Sky Harbor's General Aviation Office was made of aluminum, anodized in dark brown, bolted to a knee-high concrete wall around the patio slab. He could see everything in daylight provided by the tarmac and hangar lighting. 75 yards is a long walk in a suit and tie when it's 100 degrees. The air was dry and smelled of Jet A, and he could hear the APU running on the Lynch jet while the ground crew connected a power cord to the side of the jet. A large SUV was parked beside the Clinton jet, and within a few minutes he saw the air stairs come down in line with it. A few seconds later, he saw two Secret Service agents step down onto the tarmac and look around. They noticed him, but didn't seem to react as they each twisted the middle button on their jackets to keep them from flapping in the wind and possibly exposing their firearms. He felt he was watching diplomatic protocol as two FBI agents stepped out of the Lynch plane and did almost exactly the same things with their jackets. The men looked at one another like envoys of two generals meeting in secret and nodded, as though they were waiting for the president's poodle to poop. The four men shifted their weight from foot to foot, trying their best to look powerful and valuable. Like them, Chris looked around, checked the rooftops for snipers, and shifted his weight back and forth nervously. He wasn't supposed to be there, but maybe his press tag hanging around his neck was keeping him alive. He quickly wondered if they were asking themselves how he knew this meeting was taking place. They weren't talking very loudly, but when Chris lifted his 35mm camera and pointed the lens through the bars of the fence to take a photo, they yelled at him to put his camera away. No pictures and no recordings. You ask nothing. You stand there and you say nothing. Am I clear, mister? Asked the FBI agent from Lynch's plane. Chris nodded and waved his left hand slightly to show he heard the order and stood there silently and alone. The heat came out of the tarmac like a hot cast iron pan pulled fresh out of the oven, and the high-pitched APU began to wind down as the craft switched over to an external power. After what seemed like an hour, Bill Clinton appeared at the top of the stairs and walked down to the SUV. Maybe he was making some calls to his soldiers in the syndicate, or to a lawyer, or to lawmakers, to inform them he was going to need some cover. This meeting was going to happen, and they needed to be ready to defend it or deny it. One of the Secret Service agents opened the rear door of the SUV and closed it behind Clinton as he got inside. He couldn't tell if the former president glanced his way. Chris held his breath for a moment, as he figured Clinton knew he was there. By now he probably knew where he lived and what he had for breakfast that morning. They didn't ask him to leave. Maybe they didn't care if he was there. Or maybe they did, but this meeting was mission critical, and perhaps they were confident nothing would ever come of it. Clinton carried himself like someone who had just made a deal with the devil himself. The SUV rolled slowly around to the front of Lynch's jet, and the two front doors opened. The Secret Service agents got out and faced the FBI agents. Staging. Flanking, maybe. One of them opened the rear door of the SUV, and Clinton stepped out and walked to the stairs of the Lynch jet and stepped up inside the plane, as though she was renting it from him. The agents measured the space between them. Chris ran the copy through his mind over and over again. He couldn't take notes. He couldn't take pictures or record anything or ask any questions. There would be many questions. Who? When? what. The one that scared him was why. The agent stood in front of the airman, still at attention. He thought he could hear men speaking, but he could not see their faces as the men stood on the other side of the jet from him. Their legs looked relaxed, and he couldn't tell they were looking around for threats. He hoped he wasn't one of them. Almost an hour had passed when Clinton emerged. Did he have something in his hands? No. Did he take anything inside the plane with him when he walked up those stairs? Damn, he couldn't remember. He didn't stay around for the Clinton jet to fire up and fly away. Another black SUV pulled up to the Lynch plane, but it looked like no one was coming out until the coast was clear. He could feel the vomit close to his throat. He knew they probably wouldn't come out of the Attorney General's plane as long as he was there. Chris walked back into the lobby of General Aviation. He took a long drink from the ice-cold fountain and looked around the well-lit but empty lobby. He walked through the glass doors to the outside parking lot and dropped, exhausted, into his Camry. Christopher Sine wasn't a bit player in the Lynch-Clinton story. He was the only player in the story who uncovered it and broke the news of the secret meeting between two of America's most powerful figures. And he wasn't just a local reporter. He was an anchor on ABC 15 in Phoenix. No amount of experience could prepare him for the possible ramifications of this story. He made sure every I was dotted and every T crossed. He took 2 days almost without eating until he visualized going on air. It was like no game day or final exam he ever faced. He knew, once it was on tape, there was no going back. He also knew that no matter what he wanted, no matter how he planned or edited, it was going to get out of control. He knew he would be a target of other reporters, politicians, and even the Department of Justice itself. In football, a player is only as good as his last play. That's why you never hold back. That one extra yard might be the one big play that wins or loses the game. Big would turn out to be an understatement. The story, based on Sine's reporting, dominated the national news cycle for well over 48 hours. In fact, for months, it was included in debate after debate on global television. And it may have been the single most critical factor that affected the most watched election in history. The entire media world, with all its billions and nearly every supermodel talking head on national TV, went after him with partisan accusations, emails, phone calls, and social media attacks. But Chris was as ready as he was for every single snap of the ball throughout his life. When he was asked to appear on Fox News with Bill O'Reilly, he never wavered. Of all the things I've uncovered in my 15-year career, from serial killers and hostage situations to hurricanes and tornadoes and other natural disasters, this generated the most overwhelming response by far, he said. And the people who got me through it were my wife, my kids, my family, and my football family. The first people to congratulate me on the story were my former Alabama teammates. And on the flip side, when things were getting intense, the first people to reach out to check on me were those same teammates. During my highs and lows in life, I found myself relying so much on my teammates. Playing for Gene Stallings will do that for you. ABC 15 in Phoenix hired me to do a job, and that's what I'm doing, Sine said. Just like I did on the football field. I've always said that playing team sports sets you up to do well in life, and this is proof. Facts matter, especially when one is trying to drill down to the truth. But despite dozens of news articles from major media outlets on the private meeting between Attorney General Loretta Lynch and Bill Clinton at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport last week, the facts have typically been reported wrong, and serious questions have been left unanswered. The propaganda media churned through millions of dollars every hour on national television to make sure the public understood that both Clinton and Lynch were coincidentally in Phoenix on the same day for scheduled events. They actually developed talking points at the FBI, but FOIA requests came back redacted. They knew it was bad, but as long as the public didn't know it was bad, or that it involved grandkids and golf, Hillary could still win. But the social media knew it was a lie, and Chris made sure that his story stood the test of time in the light of day. Sheila was right. Bill Clinton was in Phoenix a couple of days prior, on Monday, June 27th, to meet with real estate developer Jim Pedersen and others. Pedersen was chair of the Arizona Democratic Party from 2001 to 2005. According to Federal Election Commission records, Pedersen gave nearly $7.3 million to the Arizona State Democratic Central Committee from 2001 to 2006. By Wednesday, June 29th at 7:41 p.m., when the details surrounding the nefarious meeting should have been made clearly established, Devlin Barrett of the Wall Street Journal was apparently misled by his sources, which one would assume included the Justice Department, on the date of the encounter. Barrett incorrectly reported that Attorney General Loretta Lynch met privately with former President Bill Clinton in Arizona in the early morning hours of Tuesday, but Ms. Lynch claimed they did not discuss Hillary Clinton's private server as Secretary of State. These were last-minute arrangements. She delivered a Monday speech at the National Summit on Youth Violence Prevention, according to her public schedule and a news report in the Baltimore Sun. The Attorney General was not scheduled to leave until the next day, but after receiving orders from Clinton, she demanded her husband accompany her as they filed a new flight plan and headed directly for the airport. He went with her for one reason only, to be a witness to the meeting Bill Clinton had requested of her. It turned out to be one of her better moves, as she would, in fact, ask for protection under the Fifth Amendment about this meeting 74 times under oath before Congress. Her husband was the only witness in the world who could not be compelled to testify against her. The word optics was used repeatedly by both Democrats and Republicans to characterize the lack of judgment by the highest law enforcement officer in the land. To engage in this tarmac meeting with the husband of a target under a criminal investigation. Within hours of the meeting, FBI Director James Comey was instructed by Attorney General Loretta Lynch to immediately change his public verbiage by referring to the Hillary Clinton investigation as a matter and to stop referring to it as an investigation. Director Comey complied. This sleight of hand dominated the Sunday talk shows. Further clouding the investigation, the Associated Press was reporting that President Obama would be campaigning alongside Hillary Clinton at an event a few days later in Charlotte, North Carolina, adding this titillating note to the story. The White House hasn't ruled out Clinton and Obama traveling to the event together on Air Force One, it reported. Using Air Force One to shuttle to campaign appearances on behalf of a candidate who is under an active criminal investigation, even the act of considering it, shows just how far Washington was completely under the control of the Clinton crime syndicate. Christopher Sine knew that hundreds of people had died trying to stop the Clintons from achieving and keeping global power. Chris tried to imagine the deal that was just made inside that plane. Perhaps Loretta Lynch would stay on as Hillary's Attorney General when she was crowned. The thought that she might have looked out the window and seen him standing there made his blood run cold. Maybe. Just maybe this story would make a difference. He felt the clock was ticking down for them. Their lust for authority and their thorough belief that they were protected from harm by special power made everyone that knew them afraid to try and stop them. Perhaps the courage of an Alabama football player with a pure heart and a pen of light would take down the most feared crime syndicate in political history. Maybe no one else would have to die, he thought to himself. He was wrong.